Hey, here we go. Welcome everyone to our Three Ideas in 30 Minutes. And this is a Rosh Chodesh Av edition. Hopefully we will tie some of the ideas into that as well. Our first idea comes from the Vizhnitzer Rebbe, Reb Chaim Yehuda Meir Mivizhnitz, in his Sefer Zecher Chaim, where he writes what I think is a beautiful insight and is a real indictment on our generation. He writes the following. The Pasuk tells us that after the war of Midian, Vayetsu Moshe ve'Elazar Kohen, v'chol nesiei Aida, that they all go out to greet the people as they come out from battle. Rashi on that pasuk tells us, l'fi she'ra'u na'arei b'nei Yisrael yotzim lachtof min habiza. So why are Moshe and Elazar going out to greet these warriors? So Rashi tells us because they see the na'arei b'nei Yisrael, the children of the Jewish people, yotzim lachtof min habiza. They're going to, what's lachtof?
Grab.
To grab. They're going to grab the spoils from the war. Ask the Vizhnitzer Rebbe, what's wrong with that? First of all, why does Rashi use the word chotvim, that they're grabbing it? Couldn't he have used a different language, a word in the Hebrew language, namely that they were lokeach, that they took? Why specifically does he use a much more aggressive term that they are chotvim? Chotvim almost means that like something doesn't belong to me and I'm grabbing it away from you. It's a pejorative term. Here, it belongs to them. They won the battle fair and square. They deserve the spoils of the war. So why does he use a negative word of chotvim that they were grabbing it? That's question number one.
Doesn't it say
two words
that says
chet? It says lachtof et min habiza, that they were grabbing it.
I'm saying this.
Yeah, that's not from the word chet, though. Not from the word chet, though. It means to grab. And number two, he asks, why is it that it says na'arei b'nei Yisrael? A na'ar is a child. Why specifically does it refer to the soldiers when they're coming back from war, those who are inappropriately taking the spoils of the war? Why does it call them the na'arei, that they are the children? So he quotes here from the Chasam Sofer, a very sharp phrase. The Chasam Sofer says that the rechush vehahon shel avos oseh roshem bilti tov al hador hatzair, that the wealth from the parents makes a negative impression on the children. Now, why is that the case? Why is it that parental or generational wealth has a negative impact on children? So again, we can hypothesize based on the Chasam Sofer that the answer is that when you don't earn the money, so it doesn't carry the same significance for you. When someone gives you something that you put no skin in the game and you put no effort in and you did not earn, so you don't value it at the same level. Says the Vizhnitzer Rebbe based on that. He says, Hine, Iker Yisodei Be'achinuch. It is a foundational, fundamental part of educating our children. Husheyeda V'yiskor Ma'amar Chazal, that they remember what the Gemara says, that kashim mizonosav shel adam kekriyas yamsuf, that the reason why the Torah compares to earning parnasa to kriyas yamsuf, and it says kasha, it's as hard as kriyas yamsuf, is because earning a parnasa should be a little effort. In other words, Hashem wants us to have skin in the game. Hashem wants us to put in the effort. He wants it to be a little difficult for us. And therefore, says the Vizhnitzer Rebbe, Eino nitan lahasigo bekalos, it should not be easy. V'yesh la'amol v'la'avod alav, you should have to work for it, you should have to put an effort for it. V'az memele yivad lo ad kamali ischashe be'otzas. And when you put an effort for something, then you fully appreciate the true value of it. That's what we call the IKEA effect, right? Those of you who've heard my spiel about the IKEA effect, I think it's insane that I get dragged to IKEA. First of all, you find me one family that's ever gone to IKEA and not come out fighting, I'll buy you some ice cream. It doesn't happen. Somehow, IKEA is like an epicenter for husbands and wives fighting. But anyways, you pay a lot of money for furniture that you have to first schlep through the place, and then they get you on the bottom there. Anyone who's ever been there, you think you're like almost out of the store, and then there's that maze, you know what I'm saying, at the bottom, where you're like, oh, I need 5 of those, and I need like 25 spatulas, and I need, you know, new curtains. And by the end, you came in for a bookshelf, and you left with an entire newly designed house. But then you get to the cashier, and then you got to figure out how to get into your car. And they give you that white rope, and they clearly have never met a Jew before, because I don't know what to do with the white rope. So I've learned over time that a $20 bill can go very far, and that people can be very helpful with a $20 bill. So not only have I paid for my own bookshelf now, but I now have to pay $20 for a guy to stick it into my car. Then I got to call my neighbor when I get back because I can't lift the bookshelf and I need him to help me bring it into my house. And then the real fun begins because the bookshelf that I just paid a lot for, I now have to figure out how to put together. And at the end, there's always that extra screw. And you're staring at the instructions and you're wondering, did they make a mistake or did I? And then you're like, will anyone notice if this screw is missing? And then you say to yourself, well, if the screw doesn't need to be there, and you play mind games with yourself, and yet the whole time, you paid for this. You paid for the privilege of building your bookshelf. Anyways, researchers have studied this, and they found that there's something called the IKEA effect, which means that you actually value the furniture more when you build it. Why? Because you put skin in the game. Because of all the fighting and all the difficulty and the storming out of the room. Oh, maybe that's just my house. I don't know. But all of that, somehow it makes you appreciate the furniture even more. Says the Vision of Sarebi, that is not just a yesod, that is not just a foundational element of IKEA, but it's the rationale behind our parsha as well. That when the Na'arim, when the children came back from war, so they were chotvim, they grabbed it. Says the Vision of Sarebi, now we understand, because it's the parents that went to battle. It's the parents, he said, that put in all the effort. And they come back and they're carrying with them all the spoils and all the bounty and all the booty. And what happens? It's sitting there piled up, and their children who didn't go out to battle, they run and they grab it. And Moshe and Elazar, they come over there, whoa, 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 whoa. If you don't put skin in the game, if you don't put in the effort, you cannot reap the rewards. And therefore, he says on page number 2 at the end, he says, Shahare Lahem, lo haya magia klal bazeh. He says, you didn't earn this. You don't have the rights to it. Umala hem im habiza. You have no right to this bounty because you did not put in the effort to it. Therefore, he says, now we understand all of the strange language in the pasuk. Why does it refer to them as the Na'arei B'nai Yisrael, the children of the Jewish people? Because they were the ones who stayed back. In other words, had it been the parents, had it been the fathers that went to battle, okay, they earned it. They deserve it. It's coming to them. But it's specifically the children who did not put in the effort, who didn't go to battle and simply want to ride the coattails of their parents in an effortless fashion, that, the Torah says, is inappropriate. And now we also understand why he uses the word chotvim. Remember, chotvim was a pejorative term. It was a negative term. And the answer was because they were taking something that they did not deserve. They didn't earn it. They didn't put in the effort. They didn't put in the skin in the game. And therefore, they were not worthy of it. I think this vision, it's her vort. It's such a beautiful idea because it reminds us that in life, while we are trying as hard as we can to be as efficient as possible, and we try to find all these hacks to make things as simplistic as possible. We've discussed this at Off the Record a few weeks ago when we were discussing ChatGPT and xenon gas and climbing Everest with no effort. We are living in a world of maximum efficiency. ChatGPT and AI, it's all making things as easy for us as possible. And yet, as I pointed out off the record, and I was the minority opinion, I actually may have been the only time when I took everybody on by myself, but I surmised that despite the fact that we are the most efficient generation in the history of mankind, don't you find it surprising that we are also the most anxious, that we are also the most depressed, that we are the most that we live the most unfulfilled lives? And the answer, I perhaps think, is because of this vort of the vision of Sarebi, which is that we find fulfillment when we put in effort. So when we rob ourselves the thrill of building something from IKEA, we don't value it as much. It doesn't give us that sense of fulfillment. It doesn't give us that sense of joy. And so I implore you that as we become a more efficient society, and as AI makes our lives easier and effortless, etc., never lose sight of the beauty of putting in effort. Never lose sight of the fulfillment that you get when you have to break your teeth over something. Teach your children and your grandchildren the value and the benefit of what it means to have to really try at something, and that is where you'll find the fulfillment. It's specifically the Na'arei B'nai Yisrael in our parsha that get castigated because they did not put in the work. They do not deserve the spoils. It's only when you put in the effort that you're worthy of the reward. That is idea number one, a beautiful idea from the Vision of Sarebi in his Sefer Zecher Chaim. Okay, idea number two comes from the Baal HaTur. Baal HaTurim on page number 3 writes the following. Moshe and Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven, the children of Gad and Reuven, have a lengthy discussion in our parsha this morning. We've discussed this in parsha classes in the past. Anyone wants to hear entire parsha shirim about them, they're welcome to go back to the old shirim. But the conversation is a very difficult conversation to understand. It almost feels sometimes when you're in marital counseling and you counsel a couple and they're not talking to each other, they're like talking over each other. In other words, one spouse is talking and the other spouse is talking, but they're just talking kind of, but they're like missing each other's point entirely. And if you read the conversation between Moshe and the children of God and Reuven, that's almost how it feels. Like Moshe will say something, the children of God and Reuven will respond, and then Moshe will respond to that, but he'll kind of reiterate what he said, and you're wondering, like, are they having the exact same conversation? And we've discussed that in the past. But one thing I want to point out here from the Baal HaTurim. The pasuk says, "Nachnu na'avor chalutzim lifnei Hashem," that Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven, the children of Gad and Reuven, they reaffirm the fact that despite the fact that they are going to settle on the east bank of the Jordan River, and they are not going to go into Eretz Yisrael with the rest of the Jewish people, nonetheless, they are going to wage battle. They are going to cross over, and they are going to participate in any war that takes place. The Baal HaTurim points out that generally, when we use the word we in the Chumash, we don't use the word nachnu, but rather we use the word anachnu. Anachnu is the classic term that is going to be used as the collective we. Says the Baal HaTurim that there are 3 times in the entire Torah where the Torah does not say anachnu with an aleph, but rather nachnu without the aleph. 1 is our parsha this coming Shabbos. Number 2 is in Sefer Bereishis, when the brothers come to Yosef and they're telling Yosef all about their family. They say, Kulanu bnei ish echad nachnu. We are all the sons of one person. Nachnu. Again, that same exact word. And lastly, we are going to read, hopefully not, but assuming that we don't get our act together and build the Beis HaMikdash shortly, in 11 days from now, we'll be sitting on the floor and we'll be reading Eicha. And in the 3rd paragraph of Eicha, we say to Hashem, Nachnu, Fashanu, Umarinu, Atalo Salachta, we have sinned and we have rebelled, and yet you, Hashem, have not forgiven us. Says the Baal HaTurim, it's the only 3 times in the entire Torah where instead of using the word anachnu, which is the classic formulation of the word, instead it uses the word nachnu with a weird variation of it. Says the Baal HaTurim why. And I want to share with you the Baal HaTurim here on page number 3. It is stunning and magnificent and so relevant in so many different ways. He writes the following, that these 3 psukim are not separate and disjointed examples, but rather they are meant to be read in one synchronized and harmonious fashion. Says the Baal HaTurim, Nachnu na'avor, that we will be successful in getting into Eretz Yisrael and in our military battles that we wage along the way. Why? Key, because the second pasuk from Sefer Bereishis, Kulanu b'nei ish echad nachnu, that the reason why we'll be successful in battle is because we are all
united.
Because we are all one people. Because we recognize that we have the same father. V'im lo, and if we don't learn that lesson, says the Baal HaTurim, then nachnu fashanu. Then we have sinned. Isn't that amazing? So the Baal HaTurim says these are not 3 disjointed psukim, but rather it's creating a narrative for us. It's explaining to us the formulation for how we, the Jewish people, are going to be successful. That nachnu na'avor, we will be successful. We will be successful into Eretz Yisrael. We will be successful in our military wars. We will be successful with the Chatufim. We will be successful. We will be successful. First of all, notice the confidence that we say that with. We will be successful. But there's only one reason. It's not because of our missiles. It's not because of our armory. It's not because of our intelligence. Rather, he says, Ki chulanu bnei ish echad nachnu. It's when we realize that we are brothers and sisters, and we have the same parents, and we come from the same lineage, that we have the same Mesorah, that we have the same tradition, that we all started Har Sinai together, that we are all chelak elokam imal, that we have all still parts of Hashem within us. And it's when we realize that, when we have that sense of unity, when we have that sense of achdus, then we're going to be nachnu navor. Then we're going to be successful. But if we fail to appreciate that, and we allow the divisiveness to eke into our lexicon once again, and if we go back to October 6th, where there was so much infighting and in divisiveness, then nachnu fashanu. Then shame on us. Then the egg is on our face. Then for 2,000 years, Hashem has been giving us the formula, and we simply haven't gotten it right. I think this is, I don't use those words lightly, a stunning and magnificent reading of these three examples. The Baal HaTorim points out that the only three times in the Torah, it can't be a coincidence. It can't be that Hashem just randomly chose three psukim in the Torah and said, oh, these three times I'm going to change from the word anachnu to nachnu. It must be that the Torah is highlighting these three examples on purpose. And he says that the reason is because they are meant to be read as a conversation, that we will be successful and we will persevere, but only key because kulanu bnei ish echad nachnu. It's when we realize that we're one people, and it's when we realize that we have one Mesorah, and it's when we realize that we have one fate and one destiny, then and only then will it be nachnu na'avor, will we be successful. And if we don't do that, v'im lo nachnu fashanu, then we will have sinned, and the burden and the onus is on us for not realizing and recognizing what this time period is meant to teach us. Obviously, with the 9 days approaching us, we just had Yom Kippur Katan. This Shabbos is Rosh Chodesh Av, the beginning of the 9 days, with all the prohibitions that are involved in the 9 days, which means that I strongly recommend you doing a lot of laundry between now and Shabbos. And if you like meat, to not bank on leftovers for next week, but to eat all your meat on Shabbos as well. But it also means that this is the time of year where we reinforce and we reaffirm these values of achdus and of unity. We talk about it so much that it sometimes sounds a little bit trite. Ah, the rabbi's giving the unity speech again. How many times have we heard about unity after October 7th? But the truth is, and I really believe this, I really believe that more than any other value, that is the value that Hashem wants from us. I could give you numerous Mamari Chazal that point to the fact that more than anything, Hashem simply wants us to get along. Now, that doesn't mean we don't have to keep the rest of the Tariyag Mitzvos, and it doesn't mean we don't have to keep the Bein Adam Lamakoms, the ones that are between us and Hashem. But Hashem makes it crystal clear over and over and over again that more important and the most important thing is that we simply learn to get along. It's the last Mishnah in all of Shas. I point this out all the time. That of all the ways that Rav Yehuda Anasi could have concluded his Mishnah in the time of the Tanaim, he concludes it with the following statement: Lo matza Kadosh Baruch Hu kli machzik bracha, ela hashalom. That the only vessel Hashem finds for blessing is peace. It's not, I mean, again, I'm not minimizing any other mitzvot in the Torah. Everything's important. Shabbos is important, and kashrus is important, and Torah, everything's important. And yet, Rav Yehuda Anasi, when he has to choose one value at the end of his entire halachic work of Mishnayos to highlight and to accentuate, what does he say? Lo machzik kli bracha ela hashalom. I always give the analogy, right? Think about the words, lo machzik kli bracha. It holds the blessing. So I give the analogy. Let's say you have like a really nice bottle of wine. Okay, I was just in Eretz Yisrael. I went to the Flam Winery, right? So I'm sitting there. I don't know if anyone's been there. It's right near Beit Shemesh. And it's stunning. You're overlooking the vineyard. It's a small boutique winery. It's really beautiful. So let's say you're sitting there with a bottle of Noble, which is the expensive Flam wine. It's delicious, by the way, if anyone hasn't tried it yet. And it's really an excellent bottle of wine. So imagine you're sitting there drinking that bottle of wine, and someone punctures a little hole in the bottom of the bottle, right? And all of a sudden, your expensive bottle of wine, I have no idea what it costs. Let's say, $50, whatever. It's more than that. Let's say it's $100. Okay, all of a sudden, it's pouring out. And you're watching there as this wine that you spent a lot of money for in some winemaker and sommelier spent a lot of time with the terroir and building up, it's just flowing onto the ground. And you're saying, what's going on here? That's the best wine. The answer is, if you don't have a jug to hold it, then the wine is meaningless. You can't enjoy it. You can't benefit from it. Says Rav Yehuda Anasi, that's what peace is. You could have all the blessing crammed into that wine bottle. You could have the nicest, fanciest, most expensive bottle of wine in the world. But if you don't have peace, and you have a hole in the bottom and it's all going to pour out. You're never going to enjoy it. You're never going to be able to benefit from it. That is the importance of peace. That is the importance of unity. That is the value and the virtue that you and I work on over the next 9 days of letting go, in giving in, in being mevater, of giving in to other people, recognizing it's just not worth it. That is what this time period is, says the Baal HaTurim. That is not just what this time period is about, but it's the secret sauce of our success. That how are we going to be Nachnu Na'avor? How are we going to be successful militarily in an Eretz Yisrael? It's only when we realize that Kulanu B'nei Yish Echad Nachnu, that we are one and we are unified. And if we don't do that, Nachnu Fashanu, then shame on us. That is idea number two from the Baal HaTurim. I think it is an incredibly powerful idea. Idea number one was from the Vision Serebi. Again, the reminder of putting in the hard work, of not just running for efficiency, but realizing the value of the effort. Idea number two from the Baal HaTurim, this unbelievable understanding of the only three cases in the Torah, of Tanakh, where it uses Nachnu without the Aleph. Idea number three is a hybrid idea. One is from the Rav Henoch Leibowitz, the Rosh Shiva of Chafetz Chaim, and the other is from my Rebbe, Rabbi Neuberger. And I believe they're saying the same thing. They say it, formulate it a little bit differently, but they're saying the same general idea, which is why I brought it from both. One is in Hebrew, one is in English. I'll try to reference it from both of them. So we know that one of the classic knocks on the children of God in Reuven for wanting to stay on the east bank of the Jordan River was that they chose what we'll call their financial success over living in Eretz Yisrael. One of the reasons they come is they talk about that they have a lot of sheep and a lot of flock, and the grass is better on the east bank of the Jordan River, so it makes more sense for them to stay on the east bank rather than going to Eretz Yisrael. And of course, Moshe Rabbeinu castigates them. And Rashi very famously says that one of the things Moshe does is he turns around the order that the children of God in Reuven put their sheep, and then they mention the children. And Moshe Rabbeinu, when he responds, put the children first and the sheep second, to almost give them a little bit of musr, to give them a shtach, to make them realize that they shouldn't put their financial material success over the values that they're teaching their children and raising their children. That's a Rashi. It's a very famous Rashi. Asks both Rav Henoch and my Rebbe, Rabbi Neuberger, the exact same question. How do you understand that the children of God and the children of Reuven would have such misplaced priorities? Here we are. They are the Dor Dea. In other words, their generation that witnessed the miracles of the desert. This was not just any random generation. Their parents were the ones who were taken out of Egypt. They grew up on their feet of their parents, hearing stories of Kriyas Yamsuf and hearing stories of Har Sinai. This is the generation that saw the Man, right? They saw miracle after miracle after miracle. How did they get to the point where they had such misplaced priorities? Says Rav Henoch here, Vitema, page number 4. Keitzad yitachin, how could it be that they were da'agula behem teim, yoser milivneim, milivnoseim? How could it be that they cared about their flock more than they cared about their children? Or in our modern day parlance, how could it be that it was worth it for them to stay in the office an extra 2 hours rather than go home and have dinner and help their children with the homework? Right? How could it be that this generation of holy Jews could have had such misplaced priorities? He says something so unbelievably profound, and it should strike the core of every single one of us. He says, Sarich Lomar, Sheba'emes tchilas ikar da'agasam haisa avor tapam. He says, you're right. When they first started out, 100% their concern was for their children. They went to work, and they said, I'm going to earn a parnasa because I want to pay for Jewish education and I want to raise my children. And everything they did, and every calculation they had, was because they wanted to raise their children properly. And because they had to earn a parnasa, so they had to stay in the office late, they had to go on the business trips, they had to deal with their cattle, they had to deal with the flock, whatever examples you want. And that takes up a lot of time. You don't just clock in, clock out. Right? There's no such thing as a 9-to-5 job anymore. 9-to-5 really means 9 to whenever or 8 to whenever. And then you come home and you got this fakakta device in front of you. So you got the emails and the text messages and the WhatsApp messages all night long, right? But I'm doing it for the children. But I'm doing it because of parnasa for my children. But he says what happened is, little by little, hitchilu l'yadcheis eleim k'inyan v'tachlis b'fnei atzmo. The parnasa became the end in and of itself, not the means to the end. The financial success as opposed to it being the means to an end, namely to raise your children, to be able to pay for Jewish education, to be able to support tzedakahs, whatever the case might be, the financial and material success became the end in and of itself. They started valuing that in an end of itself. And they completely lost sight of the fact that the whole reason they got into this was not just because of the bigger house and the nicer car and the fancier vacation, but because they wanted to raise children that were going to be Yirei Shamayim, Ibnei Torah, and Eir L'Chayidin. U'memeila higil amatzav, and eventually they got to the point where the end overtook the means. In other words, or the means overtook the end, right? Where the parnasa overtook the fact that they really wanted to do it for the sake of their children. Therefore, he says on page number 5, he says, Kal v'chomer, all the more so to us. Kol shekein she'anachnu nieh mushpa'im. All the more so do we have to be careful of how much our livelihood can influence us. Adam ha'osek rov zmano b'tzarchei mechiyaso. A person rightfully spends the majority of his life earning parnasa. We spend the majority of our life at work. And he sometimes forgets shekol avoda, that the whole reason he's doing this is laharbos es nechasav hu rak emtsai, that this is only a means to an end, and the end is to raise a bais neman b'Yisrael. The end is to be able to give tzedakah. The end is to be able to support. The end is to be able to raise. The end is to be able to teach values. The financial success, it's just a means to an end. It's not an end in of itself. But we get so caught up in it. We get so caught up in the rat race. Now, that's not why we started. We started with pure intentions. Few people go into a business with the sole goal of getting rich for the sake of getting rich. No, you have values and you have reasons for why you want to do it. But you lose sight of that along the way. Says Rav Henoch, that is what happened to the children of God in Reuven. And that is what happens to all of us. And therefore he suggests that this week's Parsha is an opportunity for us to recalibrate ourselves. Does that extra hour in the office, is it the most important thing? Or should I try to be home more for dinner with my children? Is it more valuable that I work a little longer or that I could be around to play with my grandchildren and to visit them? Right, each of us have to make our own cheshbonus, and they're not easy decisions. And I'm not saying there's a right or there's a wrong or it's clear cut. But says Rav Henoch, this is the opportunity that when we read this Rashi, before we cast judgment on the children of God of Reuven, we should look in the mirror and wonder for ourselves, are my priorities aligned correctly? Am I doing what I need to be doing for the right reason, or have I lost sight of that along the way? And somehow the material and the financial success has become the end in and of itself. Rabbi Neuberger says this in slightly different terms, but I think equally powerful. He says on page number 6, he asks the exact question. He says, in years gone by, I felt that the criticism was unduly harsh and undeserved. Did Moshe really believe that these Jews would protect their sheep before making their children safe? Says Rabbi Neuberger in my next underline, but consider this. Again, the decision that they made for a right reason. They had every validation to be able to make the decision that they made. He said, but consider this. Every Yontif, when they would travel to Yerushalayim and the children would ask for hours, are we there yet? Why do we live so far from Yerushalayim? And undoubtedly we were here on the same trip. Why can't we stay home this time? Why can't we visit Yerushalayim more often and stay longer? In other words, the children would be craving more spirituality. They'd say, Daddy, why do we live so far away? Why can't, and I'll give you the modern day example, and I'm sorry if I'm going to be a little harsh right now, right? Why don't we make minyan? Why don't we make time in the Beis Medrash? Okay. So whereas their response to Moshe may have been some unthinking and unfortunate gaff. The honest and perhaps frequent parental answer would be quite different. Every aliyah, l'regel, would indeed communicate that our wealth, our family business, our financial security, and our large promises all keep us far from Yerushalayim and make our trips there difficult and less frequent. Truth be told, over the course of the 14 years, the fathers were absent, even if for only periods of time. Don't forget, a lot of the times the father went and the children had to stay back. Undoubtedly, their children would need help learning the daf, or had to sit alone in shul, or wondering before retiring, where did Abba call from? And they would find out that it was all because of the sheep. In other words, their parents made decisions. Now, each decision in and of itself could be a correct decision. But the net result is that there are consequences to the decisions that we make. And we make choices. We make choices about what Rabbi Neuberger refers to as the financial success. And where does he write that? About our wealth and our family business and our financial security and the promises. We make choices. And this parsha, therefore, is an opportunity for us to recalibrate those choices, to have sometimes difficult conversations with ourselves of how have we conflated and confused what the end is and what the mean should be. That the end result is that we want to be able to give tzedakah, that we want to be able to support Jewish education, that we want to be able to raise children that have the right values and that are B'nai Torah and that go to Jewish education and are Ehrlich and are Menches. That's the end goal. Everything we do up until that point is just to help us and enable us to get that. And sometimes we lose sight of that, but both Rav Henoch and Rabbi Neuberger encourage us to use this week's Parsha as the opportunity to recalibrate those priorities. And so we saw three ideas in 30 minutes. For some reason it felt it went by quicker tonight. Maybe, I don't know why. But we saw the vision Serebi about hard work and effort to not lose sight of that. The value, just remember the IKEA effect. Idea number two, we saw from the Baal HaTurim, the beautiful reminder of the power and the importance of unity, especially this time of year, and how unity is the prerequisite to our military success in Israel. Those are not my words. Those are the Baal HaTurim's words. And number three is this harsh mussar, I would say, from Rav Henoch and Rabbi Neuberger, how this week's Parsha is an opportunity for us to recalibrate our priorities. No one makes the bad decision at the outset. Everyone makes the right decision. But over time, you start losing sight of what the means is and what the end should be. And therefore, this week's Parsha is an opportunity for us to recalibrate what is truly important, why we do what we do, why Hashem put us on this earth, what our ultimate purpose is, why Hashem gave us the gifts and the talents and the resources and the abilities that He did. And I promise you, it is not to keep it to yourself, but it's to share it with other people and to raise families and communities that perpetuate and sustain our Mesorah for the next generation. And with that, I wish you all a good Shabbos.
Thank you.